minister and slowly works his way to take control over the government. And then Haman comes in and tells the king he wants to kill Vashti. I'm sorry. He wants to kill the Jewish people. Now, first he wants to kill the Jewish people. Okay, that decree happens on the 13th of Nisan. He comes to meet the king on the 12th or the 13th of Nisan, and he says, let's wipe out all of the Jewish people. Okay, so that's on the 12th of Nisan. Okay, Mordechai gets wind of that, right? He goes and tells Esther. Mm-hmm. Esther invites the king to the party, and the next day they come to the party. That day they come to the party.
The dinner for the three of them.
What you would call a dinner, yes.
Right.
In the Megillah, it's referred to as a mishta also, okay. as a banquet. Wine was served. So they have that. She then invites him again. That night, the king can't sleep. Between the first party and the second party, or the first dinner and the second dinner, the king couldn't sleep. Haman, at the same time, is also not sleeping, because Haman is busy building a gallows to hang Mordechai, because it is irking him to no end that Mordechai is not bowing, and therefore, in his ego, he cannot wait the 11th month, 11 months. Remember, the king had already ordered the killing of all Jewish people. Therefore, Mordechai would have been killed 11 months later. But the thing was, bothered Haman, wasn't it? It bothered him that he couldn't wait the 11 months. He couldn't bear to wait, and therefore he needed a second decree of the king to kill Mordechai. Supposedly, the reason he needed the king's agreement was because Mordechai was a king's court advisor. Right? He was a king's court advisor, and therefore that's why he couldn't kill him. I don't think Haman would have had, being the prime minister, he could have killed anybody else, any other Jew. I don't think that was the problem. The problem was that Mordechai was a court advisor. And then the next morning is when Esther pointed out Haman is the evil one, and Haman gets hanged. And we all know that. Now here, Esther either miscalculated or understood the problem, but that does not get rid of the decree. After Haman is killed, it does not cause the decree to go away. The decree was a king's court decree. Mm. At that point, even though Haman was the prime minister, it was sealed with the signet ring of the king. So therefore, just because Haman died, would not itself get rid of the decree. Mm-hmm. They also had another problem, which the Megillah tells us, that you could not repeal a decree. Right?
You had to create a new decree.
You cannot repeal the decree. Some explain, it's interesting, why could they not repeal the decree? Why could they repeal the decree? What's the big deal? So repeal the decree. So it's something interesting. They can't repeal the decree because then you would never have the ability to know. Some suggest because then how do you know what the decree is? Otherwise, you'll have fraud constantly going on in the government. So that's how some want to suggest that was a way to prevent fraud. It could also be that the king was infallible. So therefore, it's as if, you remember, they believed that the kings were of the divine rights of kings. So therefore, they bowed before kings, even more than an honorary bow. And therefore, could be that if the king's infallible, so therefore, how could he have a repeal of a decree? And therefore, he tells Mordechai and Esther to write a counter decree. Right? So they don't say that you can't kill the Jews. They simply say is that the Jews have a right to defend themselves. And it was understood with Mordechai signing the decree, obviously he's going to take a personal interest in anybody who participates. But that was months before. This decree went out a few months into the year. It wasn't Nisan anymore. It was already 2 or 3 months later. And the decree went out to everybody. And then 11 months later, from when Mordechai became the prime minister, is when the actual defense of the Jewish people, or their annihilation of the major enemies of the people, took place. So it was over a period, the 3 days for the turnaround, and then 11 months for the effect of the turnaround, where they took. Now, it was still in danger. There was a certain amount of danger that could have happened to the Jewish people. So therefore, that's why we celebrate the miracle of Purim. Because even though the turnaround took place inside of the 3 days, But we don't. We went. The decree stood on the books. The Jews could have been killed. Therefore, God had to create the favor and fear in the masses of the people in order to save the Jewish people. And that's why we celebrate Purim as the miracle and not Pesach. I did see once in one place it says that there's a minhag to eat seeds on Pesach, if I remember correctly. Minhag to eat some type of a thing on Pesach because, maybe by Sephardim, I don't think we eat seeds, but because of as a memory for Esther's meal. Something like that. I don't remember exactly what I saw, but I remember seeing something of that sort.
She only ate vegetarian seeds.
Right. She only ate vegetarian, remembering that she was the one that brought about the miracle. I did see on Purim some have a minhag to eat seeds. I never saw anybody do it, but I did see. I think someone said that that's why they have poppy seed. They have poppy seed. Humantashen.
So just to make sure I have it clear, you're saying that the celebration is the lottery.
The celebration is the date that the lottery fell upon. Now, part of that was the miracle, is because had Haman not chosen that date, if he would have chosen an earlier date, it could be that we wouldn't have had enough time for Mordechai to be in place as the prime minister, and people would not have been so fearful to kill the Jews. You know, people were because Mordechai had such, he had 11 years of influence, 11 months of influence on the government already. All of the main ministers around the countries had already known that he was in charge. So therefore, you didn't want to irk the guy.
When Haman paraded him through Shushan, that mm-hmm. also was validating.
Right. I saw something interesting. In the song, it says, Shoshana Yaakov, Tzalav Asamech, a famous song that we sing after we read the Megillah. Shoshana is the rose of Jacob. So Alav Asamecha was saved and joyous. Virosam Yachad, when they saw together, Tchelas Mordechai, the Tchelas, the blue wool of Mordechai. Right? Right? So the question is, and then it says, cursed is Haman, blessed is Mordechai, cursed is Zeresh, the wife of Haman, blessed is Esther, and also Harvan is remembered for the good. What does it mean when they saw together the blue wool of Mordechai? So the simple... So the simple reading of it is, when they saw the royal garments of Mordechai, they saw that Mordechai was wearing royal garments, right? But what was of all the things to choose, right? What are you choosing that? And also, is that, what do you mean? It should say, when they saw the crown, that was the horse that Mordechai was riding upon, what is the tchelet? So Vivian said, and I just saw this in the Sefer, I never heard this before, is that, when the Jews saw a person being paraded on the horse, and someone saying, so shall be done for the man that finds favor in the king, and there's a royal horse, and there's royal everything, who did they think was on the horse? Who did everybody think was on the horse?
Haman.
Haman's daughter thought Haman was on the horse. Haman is the most important minister for the last who knows how many years. So they assumed it was Haman. Okay? When you see somebody at a distance, what do you see? You see just the horse and the clothing. You can't see the person's face from a distance until he gets closer. Mm. Right? So how did they tell it was Mordechai from a distance? When the Jews saw, the guy's wearing blue? What in the world is going on? That's Mordechai. I don't believe it. What the heck is he doing on the horse? Right, so that's when they saw the whole thing. Something is turning here, and then they recognize that Haman's on the ground. Right, that something is obviously very wrong or very right about what's going on. So that was a cute understanding of that song.
All right, so now we know that everybody knew Haman was not Haman. Mordechai was Jewish. Everybody knew that Mordechai was Jewish, but he was still on the king's court. And everybody knew that Esther came from Mordechai's house.
At that point, yeah.
So how could they not think that Esther's Jewish?
They knew that Esther was Jewish.
I thought they kept
which
it.
One minute, where are you? Are you after the after Haman's killed her before?
Well, you said that he was on the court. He was one of the king's courtsmen.
All ministers. Mordechai. All the courts always had Jews. Even the evilest, even Nebuchadnezzar that had murdered millions.
All right, so they knew that Mordechai was Jewish when he was appointed to the court.
That's correct, but they didn't know that he was related to Esther.
She came out of his home.
No, she revealed it.
She changed her name. Her name was Hadassah in his home, and then she changed it to Esther, and they didn't know that she came.
She confessed
and he
it.
Told her to tell that.
She went downtown and got a new social security number.
I know when she confessed it, but I'm trying to think, why would she have to confess it if they knew that they took her from his home?
They didn't take her from the home. They grabbed the girls off the streets. Right? They grabbed the girls off the streets and they purposely, see, it's the exact opposite. They purposely did not want to have records of the girls because what was the king's decree? Was that they can only take besulos, unmarried girls. Mm-hmm. And what did they do? They took anybody. Uh-huh. Why? Because it's interesting. You would have thought if the king is going to choose a bride, everybody wants the king to be my son-in-law. Right? You would think that they rushed forward with their daughters. What does the Gemara say? The Gemara says the opposite. Everybody hid their daughters in the cellars. Everybody, you know, put pock marks on all of the girls with mascara or whatever. Right? Because nobody wants. This guy's a nut. This guy's a flipping nut. Nobody wanted. So there was no girls. There was no girls that were there in the pageant.
Well, after right. what he did to Vashti.
That's right, why exactly. Right. He was like Richard. Who was the English king? That was the king. I did that. Sorry, good
Richard.
Well, Henry.
Henry wasn't too great. The eighth? Killed a few wives.
Even if he didn't choose the girl, she was in the harem for a year.
He used her for one night,
and then he put her back in the harem for the rest of her life.
He even had his own pope.
Yeah.
Correct. Correct. So he was certainly a nut. The guy was an absolute nut.
Thank you. No, I understand.
Okay.
There's a few nuts that are reigning at the moment.
So I have a question about the but we've already taken time.
Do you know how to turn off the...
Yes.
No, sorry?
Should I ask my question?
You can ask. We can always refuse to answer.
Okay. It says, I never noticed this before, that after the people were bad with the golden calf, the people, I guess the righteous people, slaughtered like thousands of sinners, but then the people that were left were also sinners.
Right, correct.
And it's that and Pinchas. I feel that is justification for fanatical violence, for fundamentalist violent action.
Yes.
And it bothers me that that's in our text, and okay. I want to know what do we say about it being
excellent.
There.
Okay, good. there's two answers. Oh, I'm sorry, it's one answer with two parts. And it's a very simple answer. This question that you're asking was what the Novominsker Rebbe said a few years ago at one of the great conferences. So he said, also when there was something with the stones, or something that had happened, so he said the following. Your question is that how could it be that the Bible should have such a story where you see what seems to be fundamentalism or fanaticism? So if you look in both parts, you have two pieces that are critical. And one piece without the other would not be sufficient. Number one, you see it has to be by God's command, okay, by the mitzvah. But that alone will not answer the question.
But people can look in the text and say this is God's command.
So now we need a second.
Okay.
Now you need two parts.
Yeah.
You need a second part. The second part is that you need both of them had the character of a direct relationship between. But let me ask you another question. I'm sorry. Where in the Bible do you find what would have been a similar action that was criticized? In what seems to be a aggressive fashion that was criticized. You have the same thing by Pinchas. You have the same thing by Pinchas.
With Dina, no?
Right, with Dina.
That's right.
By Dina, you see the same action that Zimri did, that Pinchas did, except it's criticized by Jacob. Wherein lies the difference? So if you look, by what What happened by Pinchas? Let's take Pinchas.
Well, with Pinchas, it was a desecration.
That's true. It was a desecration.
It was a personal family thing.
Okay. That's true, but that's not... you're right, but I want to look for a slightly different nuance. You're correct. It could be no. But the difference is that by Pinchas, the Medrash tells us that Pinchas came to Moses, and he asked Moses, what should I do? Very strange Midrash, right? So Moshe answered him, he that remembers the law shall do the law. Well, what's the lesson of that Medrash, says the Novominsker, right? That the lesson is that even kanaos, even zealotry, must have a Rebbe, must have a teacher. You cannot... Once a person goes out on their own without a teacher, he's going to be finished. One second. I answered. I know. When I went to the APEC conference, so one should know that in APEC, so of course, when you get out of the taxi, so the first day, there's all of these people occupy APEC, right? All of the radical left, save all the anti-Israel, the radical left, are all there surrounding the building, along with 5,000 other police officers, right, surrounding the building. They were not very religious because they were not there the second day. I don't know what happened to them. I was very disappointed. But there's nobody. Everybody left, except for there was one group that was there the second day. And that was, right, a radical group of people that called themselves Neturei Karta. Right, they were there. Right, they're anti the state of Israel, so they were there. Now, the reason why I don't like to use the word Neturei Karta is because Neturei Karta has, this is the radical element of Neturei Karta, by Weiss, I think his name is. Okay. There one must understand, we have fringe groups in the Jewish people that have no leadership. Once you have no leadership, you are finished. This is famous.
Have there rabbis?
No. There is no... reputable, it has to be. You see, I'm also a rabbi. Doesn't
well,
mean anything.
Reputable amongst whom? I mean, everybody has their own.
Judaism has always produced an understanding of what reputable means. We have never been absent reputable. You can't just see. The problem is we use the word rabbi very freely, but historically it has not been like that.
You had Yigal Amir, had a rabbi. Had rabbis that the guy that assassinated.
Oh, please.
They were reputable. Yeah. I mean,
there is no one reputable. Judaism has always had the ability to siphon off people that were not reputable. You see, the challenge is that we look at reputable as the Rav Moshe Feinsteins. There has never been a tolerance. We're calling every person that we call rabbi, right? Does not mean nothing, right? I love, in general, a rabbi doesn't refer to himself as rabbi. That's usual. A famous story. There was a famous case in Europe. famous court case in Europe that they brought a letter from Rav Landau, right? They brought a letter from Rav Landau. It had to do with a marriage case. So this woman brought a whole long letter supporting her side from Rav Landau, right? And they brought it for the court in a different city, right? And it was a very impressive letter of halachic content, right? Explaining why this position of this woman is totally correct and that the court should side in favor with this woman. So there was, Bezdin has three judges. So two of the judges were very impressed. They're reading through it. And I can't remember who the other one was. One of the great rabbis at the time. But remember, this is hundreds of miles away. There's no telephones. Okay? He goes to the letter. Okay? He says, okay, we're going to recess. And he goes to the letter. He says, it's false. The whole letter is fraudulent. Look, how the heck can you know that the letter is fraudulent? It's genius. The content is genius. Everything about it is genius. How could you know that it's fraudulent? Right? So he says, it's very simple. Rav Landau would never assign his name Rabbi Landau. Mm-hmm. It was in Hebrew, but it was signed Rabbi Yehuda ben... Blah, 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 blah. He says, no, he's never going to write his name Rabbi. He's going to sign his name Yehuda ben... What do you call it? He says, not a chance. So sure enough, he says the case. He said he sent the note. Of course, it came back that it was false. I never written the letter. Right? I always laugh when I call. It's always interesting when you're speaking to colleagues from the cross-section of the Jewish people. Right? You can always tell who has a low self-esteem and who has a radical disease. Because no rabbi, when I'm talking to, I never say rabbi. And I'm dealing with sometimes a congregation, I think. But you don't, you never call another rabbi and say it's Rabbi Van. It's unheard of. There's no such thing. The Jewish people have always had a way of understanding, right? Not every person with a title has the title, right? There's no such thing. We asked, last night someone was telling me that they met this nut case from the Turikarta. It's not the Turikarta, it's the fringe element of the Turikarta. It's very dangerous to use the word. Because then the other Turikarta, they're not supporters of the state, but they're not idiots. They're not morons. So they asked him, right? They asked, who's your Rebbe? Who's your Rebbe? He goes, you're nobody. You can't be self-professed. Pinchas, I can guarantee you, Pinchas knew more Torah. Pinchas was the fifth in line of the Jewish people, right? If you go down, he was the fifth in line, right, of the Jewish people. Right? He probably was a pretty smart guy. And he probably was a pretty big tzaddik. And he probably knew the law, which he did on his own. So what do you have to ask Moses for? The answer is, you have to have a Moses. You have to have a Moses. I told a friend, right, and there's no question in my mind, it is an absolute truth. Every rabbi must have a rebbe. Right? Otherwise, you're going to think, you always think you're right. I want you to know, I think I'm an absolute genius, and I'm always right. There has to be someone that can tell you you're wrong. Right? You have to have someone that can tell you you're wrong. What? Otherwise, you're going to go right. You're right. Otherwise, you're going to go right off the cliff. You're going to go right off the cliff. That's what happens. There's a famous article that was printed. Not famous, but in the rabbinic circles. Some person wrote, right, someone my age, he wrote an article, right, a 110-page article in halakha, in Jewish law. Okay? Right? It's very nice, but the article is wrong. There's no question that he's wrong. Right? His mistake is not in writing the article. His mistake was that he didn't show it to his teacher before he published the article. You can't come up with, if you're 45 years old and you have no one that could tell you you're wrong, you're finished. You will never remain in the Jewish people because you're going to write yourself right out of history, right? You're going to write yourself right out of history because it can't be. Jewish Judaism is based upon having a Mesorah, having a tradition, right? There are famous stories that Rav Moshe would write something and he would send it to what he called it. He would send it to somebody. Rabbi Shlomo Zalman would send it to Rabbi Yashiv. Right? Right? And it's interesting. Sometimes, even if they disagreed, he wouldn't rescind it, and sometimes he would. Right? Because there's room for latitude for disagreement. But there's a certain amount of, sometimes a person doesn't think of something. But if you can't have a teacher that could tell you you're wrong, you are finished. Right? And that's what you see. By Moshe Rabbeinu, it had to come from Moses. On the command of God to do those actions, it had to be from Pinchas had to come with the acquiescence of Moshe saying yes, you're correct. But if you're going to act without, now you can ask me a different question. Now you can ask me, okay, the Arabs also have their pastors or imams. I mean, okay, so there you have a different question. You're correct. They're doing it for the sake of God, and they have an imam. Okay. That's all true. The problem is that at some point, you have better be sure that you're right. Right? Now, you can ask me. You also have to take a look, a step back, and ask, okay, so why don't I go also follow an imam? The answer is that I think that to a certain extent, logic has it. What do you pray for? Do you pray for zealotry, or do you pray for peace? Right? What was the bracha given to Pinchas? Busi Shalom. Right? The Treaty of Peace. I mean, that has to be what you're praying for. Yeah.
Okay. I don't want
to... But there has to be a place...
I just want to say that if you look at Israel, and you look at those violent acts over a lot of time, there are three that I can think of. It started with this guy, Emil Greenslag, when Peace Now was demonstrating, a religious person shot him and killed him. And then it continues with Baruch Goldstein, who went into the Cave of the Patriarchs and shot it.
Baruch Goldstein, I don't know if it's a good example. And Baruch Goldstein, I don't know.
I don't think he had a rabbi. He just broke.
I don't think, because Baruch Goldstein saved many Arabs' lives. So you can't. I think that you have to understand that it probably would seem to be either they had a nervous breakdown or that something went wrong that we don't know on the field. I'm just in that particular case.
All right, well, let's discuss that offline. And then you have, you know, Yigal Amir. And now you have the many instances. Beit Shemesh is the latest, most really crazy one where they attacked spit on an 8-year-old girl. But you have incidents like that of stone throwing, people driving cars, in neighborhoods in Jerusalem. The violence, that kind of zealous violence, doesn't come from the non-religious. It comes from out of the religious community.
And when I look at these texts, it
worries me. That's all. And the rabbis that look at these texts, the rabbis themselves, and read here. Mm-hmm. Yes, do whatever you need to do because this is such a danger to the Jewish people. They see it that way. That is their worldview.
There has to be. So I think there's two very quick points. I think that there's tremendous dangers in the secular community as well. I want you to know. I personally saw it. I personally was very close with a extremely left family while I lived in Israel. For them, it was very difficult for them to understand and relate with me. They could not understand, because Israel's different. It's not the United States. They don't have people that can wear a black hat and have a degree, which is itself a problem. But I think that you have to study carefully. Israel has great challenges ahead of itself. I think the news that you brought me today, where the people are bypassing the media and the government and working together in unity, is really the only hope of the Jewish people. The government, unfortunately, is the desire for power is something beyond, it has its own life of its own, and to stay in power. And that's a challenge that the Israeli government, the way the government is designed, the inherent structure of government in Israel, is a problem. It's a problem. Yeah. And the media, similar to the United States, the media itself is an extraordinarily radical left-dominated media. There's some elements that are a little bit changing, but that is a challenge. You also have tremendous antagonism between the two parties. It's unlike the United States, where you have to understand this, they don't cross paths like we do in the United States. See, by us, we have religious, not really all these things, but in business, we're all on the same business table. Okay, so we all talk to each other, right? And then on Saturday, we do whatever we want. Okay, but we're all at the same table during the week doing business. In Israel, it doesn't work like that. Right? In Israel, the great challenge that they face is that people have absolutely nothing to do with each other. We had a girl come to the shul here, right? We had a girl coming, visiting from Israel on the student exchange program, right? She lived in Israel her whole life. She told us, she told me that I was the first rabbi that she remembers ever meeting. It's in the state of Israel, not Russia. Okay, this is the state of Israel. This is the first rabbi. I was the first rabbi she had ever remembered meeting. Okay, and she was, I think, 17, 18. Okay. The people simply have nothing to do with each other. Right? As much as that's hard to imagine, they have absolutely nothing to do with each other. Right? That's the greatest danger, in my humble opinion. That's the greatest danger for Israel.
You speak of the secular and the...
And the religious, yeah. They don't meet.
There are many efforts in Israel to bring them together, especially through Torah study.
You're correct.
The secular people also want to study.
Correct, but the problem is that the very fact that there are efforts out there tells you that we have a very serious problem. There's a big gap that needs to be filled. So that to me is it has to be a grassroots solution. It really has to be a grassroots solution. But there's a lot of hostility on both sides. I don't think... And I think we really have to understand really where the background is in it. But a person has to be able to see. I mean, if you want to, Rabbi Dr. Gottlieb, the professor of philosophy at Johns Hopkins, right, later he went to Or Sameach, he has a whole series on understanding, knowing you're right. Right? You have to be able to have a fail-safe program for knowing you're right. How do you know anything? Right? How do you know anything? How do you know that this phone exists? Right? And that's really a system. You have to be able to test and retest and retest to know that you're right. Right? So the fact that there's violence doesn't say it's right or wrong. That's a fact that there's violence. Now the question is, okay, so how do you know you're right? Right? What's the historical context? Right? What's happening all around? What are the things? Is it fringe? Is it real? Was it taught by teachers? Very rarely are you going to find that any of these actions have themselves teachers. But the very fact that you have cited a number of incidences, right, the fact that you could put them and count them itself tells you that you're probably doing okay in the long-term historical perspective. Because in the area, just taking from the Palestinian side, the incidences are so many and can't be counted. For me, the end of the peace treaty, or the hope of maybe that it would have worked, really was that story where the guy held up his hands with the blood when they ripped those two guys apart by hand. To me, that was over. It was not going to be. Not in this generation. Because it's not their goal. And it's not their goal. Peace is something that you desire in your heart. And one of the most beautiful things of the Jewish people is that we all desire peace at the end of the day. Right? Right? So that's the thing. Listen, do we have to pray for it? Of course we have to pray for it. We have to pray that ultimately it'll come. Right? And you have to work toward it. But you can't be an idiot. Can't be a moron either. Can't be a moron. Right? You have to make sure that the other side also wants to be at peace. That's really, I think, the challenge. You know, you can't demand peace. Because it's also egocentrical. You have to work toward it. Okay. But the main lesson is the person has to have a teacher and someone has to have someone that can tell you you're wrong. So that's really, to me, is the most important lesson we can take from any of these things, is you have to have someone to tell you wrong. The minute you have no one that can tell you you're wrong, you know that you're very likely to be going off the deep end. You know, and that's the... okay.
Rabbi.
Yes, sir.
A little problem that probably everybody who has read it has it too, because it's hard to deal with this. In this parsha, at least in two instances, it says that whoever does kind of violate the Shabbat has to be put to death.
Mm. Right.
How do we read that?
Okay. It's funny, my daughter asked me that on the way home yesterday. Oh, not my daughter, I'm sorry. Somebody else. If a person lives in the garden of the king, in the palace of the king, and he insults the king, or a person lives in the 127th province, all the way out in some boondock, you know, and he insults the king, right? The punishments are not equal. Because one is you're insulting the king in the face of the king, right? Right? The Torah, the Shabbat, is the very definition of God's presence in the world. It's the most holy day, but it's more than the most holy day. Well, the purpose of the Shabbat is recognizing God as the creator of the universe. Right? That's the central point of the Shabbat, and that's why the Shabbat is recognizing the creator is the most important of all mitzvot almost in the Torah. So therefore, it carries with it the greatest consequence of its denial. So therefore, in a time of a perfect system where we're all in the court of the king, in the king's palace, so therefore it carried with it the greatest and most severe of consequences, right? When we're not in the court of the king, so therefore even though the day remains the most special of all days and it remains the most important of all days and its principles remain intact, the consequence does not remain at the same level. Right, the importance remains. Right, we don't change. The Shabbos remains the Shabbos. The laws remain the laws. Right, we have to push ourselves and maximize our ability to observe it to its maximum. The only thing that changes is the consequence, not the commandment. So therefore, but in the Messianic age, for example, where the glory of God will be revealed to all, so to speak, and we'll all be again in the palace of the king, and the system will again be perfect, then again the consequence of action would be there. But also to remember is the consequence of action will be in the time when the obviousness of God's presence will be there and recognized and will all be in a perfect system. So therefore is that, that a person is unlikely to do something where they're in a perfect system.
Yeah, but I understand all you're saying, but you know, this is very difficult to explain, particularly to a non-Jew. This is not something that has ever been done, right? Because somebody violates the Shabbat, he's put to death.
It requires with it warning, right? Remember, in order to have anybody put to death in the Judaic system, mm-hmm. he has to have a warning. And then he has to say, even so, mm-hmm. I'm going to do it anyway. And they're warning him, but you realize that with this carries the penalty of death, and you're going to be killed. And the person says, even so, I want to do it anyway. Right, so that's how the process of the warning system would take place, as well as the witnesses. And then the witnesses would go to the court. And then the court would try to find different ways to see if the person, A, is guilty, and B, is if there's any means of merit to find a way that he would not be guilty. And then he would be put to death. There's only one there is one person that was put to death, and the Bible itself says, Mikoshesh Eitzim, the person that was gathering the wood sticks. So it says he did it in order to teach the people, right? It says an interesting thing about him. It says he was the father of Tzelofchad. He was the father of the daughters, those five girls that asked for their share in the land of Israel. So it says, our father did not die in the rebellion against God. Right, he died because of this law. It says that he wanted to teach the people that the Shabbat is real. This is not some theoretical thing. It says he wanted to teach the people that this is a serious matter and to take it seriously. So he sacrificed himself. I don't advise it, right? But he sacrificed himself for this, to teach this lesson to the Jewish people. So I believe it's a Medrash. Rashi, I think, quotes it later. But it does it. You see the seriousness of the Shabbat. Yeah, the Shabbat is a very serious thing. The Torah has a number of principles similar to the Shabbat.
Children, weren't there great efforts taken not to stone a child? I mean,
well, a child can't. You're talking about the rebellious child. Yeah. The rebellious child, the Gemara says, "Lo haya v'lo yiyye." It never was and never will be, because the amount of technical details involved make it impossible to happen. Right? I think that you have to. We talked about this, I think, a few weeks ago. That the Judaism has a very, the written law is extraordinarily strict, and the oral law is extremely kind. Right? An eye for an eye, says the Bible. Says the rabbis, or says the oral tradition, it means money. So if it means money, why does the Torah say an eye for an eye? So we said, the Torah is teaching you, you have to approach it with the strictest of measures. When you have to feel that they're going to knock your eye out. That's how serious God takes it, right? When you hurt somebody else, you have to really be worried about it, right? But once the action happened already, right, then the softness applies. And that's often in Judaism, right? A good teacher has to have a very big stick and a very soft voice, right? Because it's that balance, right? We never want to inflict punishment. Right, right. That's also, I think, Vivian, what we were talking about before. It has to have a base desire that you never want these types of things to happen. That has to come from the person. It has to be the overarching love. Because it's not necessary. You got to speak. No, you're going to have to do this, and you're going to have to do this. Right. But ultimately, is that there's no desire for such a thing. Right. So we have to approach the Shabbat with the approach of Mos Yomos of yes, this has capital punishment. This is the strictest of things. Right? But in terms of carrying it out, there you see the court said that a court that had more than one every 70 years had a capital case more than once every 70 years is a bloody court. Right? So you see that there is an inconsistency. Right? The inconsistency is not in the truths. The inconsistency is that we're trying to give an impression, the same way that the Bible describes, in general, you see Tanakh is like this, by King David, right? It says King David sinned with Bathsheba. Famous, right? He sinned with Bathsheba, right? It's recorded in the Bible for all history to see. So we once quoted, 1 or 2 years ago, we quoted the Medrash that says, you know, King David was having a conversation with God, and he told God, you know, I think it would be much better if we left this chapter out.
Make it a mystery.
Right. Why don't we just, you know what I mean? Let's leave this chapter out. I think it'll work. The Bible will work just as well. It'll probably sell as many copies, right? I'll sell a few less copies, but you know what I mean? Why do we need this chapter? And so God says, no, we need this chapter. Second problem is that it doesn't fit with the Gemara. Because the Gemara says that King David did not sin with Bathsheba. The Gemara says that Bathsheba technically was allowed to be with King David. She technically was divorced. Right? So why does the Torah record it that he sinned? And the Gemara has a number of other cases where they speak about it wasn't really a sin, this wasn't a sin, and this wasn't a sin. So if the Gemara is right, which our tradition is that it is, but so why does it write it that way? The answer is that the Torah is trying to teach us two lessons. One is, if it writes that the whole violation was only a traffic ticket, and not some radical violation of some major law, so we're not going to learn anything from it. Mm-hmm. There's nothing there for us, because we can't deal in such infinitesimally small sins. Right? So therefore, since it writes it in a very radical fashion that gains our attention, and says, on King David's level, that sin was equal to this. And therefore, is you draw whatever you need. Right? You draw, if you're the lowest level, you can draw on the high, on the lowest level of sin. If you're on a higher level, be careful, because realize God expects more. Mm. Right? God expects more. So therefore, whatever level you're at, right? That's how we understand how the Torah's structure is to write. Because the Torah is speaking to you and I throughout all millennia, throughout all generations. Therefore, it says on that type of a story, we can learn out. In terms of God told him, what did God answer King David? Why can't we just leave out this chapter? So God said, I need that chapter because I need to teach everybody that no matter how dastardly the sin, there's always room for repentance.
Well, even with the lottery, King David, I read, authorized the lottery that...
Right. He had to repent. That there's always a chance to repent. A person can never say that for me it's too late. Right here you have King David, that all of history will speak of his mistake. But the greatness of King David is they're also going to speak of his repentance. But there's always the ability for a person to repent. It's never too late for a person. Right, so that's the... good? Right. How many minutes do I have left? Two. Okay. Okay. Okay.
I'm sorry.
Chocolate is an excellent way to stay awake. I did it in all my younger years.
Well, it's sugar.
Right.
That's caffeine.
It also helps the pain.
They say it's healthy.
So they say.
I think it's bittersweet chocolate. Substance. I think that they say I think the dark is healthy.
Yeah.
I eat it, please. I know. Okay, that's why I feel so good. All right. I said that we're going to discuss a point. We have 2-3 minutes. Let's just talk about a pasuk in the Torah that seems to be a problem. If you turn quickly to... apologize, I'm sorry, let me just find it. It says that King... okay, what happened in this week's parsha? We know that the Jewish people sinned with the sin of the golden calf. So then God says, I want to destroy the people. So Moshe said, you know, if you're going to destroy them, so God said, leave me alone and get out of here because the people have sinned. So Moshe comes down, he sees that they sinned with the Ten Commandments. They sinned, so he takes the Ten Commandments and he throws them on the ground and he breaks them. Why did he break them?
God, here it is.
That's how he broke them. Why did he break them? Why did he break them?
Because he was fed up.
Moses didn't feel that the people deserved them.
Right. He said that the only way to draw them back was through shock therapy. Right? was to shock them back into reality of what they had done. Okay? So then Moshe then does shuttle diplomacy, right? And he goes back and forth between heaven and earth, right? Trying to gain a reprieve from the Jewish people, and finally trying to then gain back that God should once again desire the people. Okay? Now here you end up trying to take a very long idea and make it very short. Look at page 505. Okay. I'm in verse 15 and 16. So God tells Moshe, okay, I'm not going to travel with you. Then God says, okay, I will travel with you. So Moshe says, if your presence does not go along, do not bring us forward from here. We want you, God, in our midst. How then will it be known that I found favor in your eyes, I and your people, unless you accompany us? And I and your people are distinct from every people on the face of the earth. So then God said, okay, I'll do this for you too. I'd like to focus on the words, V'niflinu ani v'amcha mikal amasho pnei adamah. And we will be distinct, I and your people, from all of the peoples on the face of the earth. Meaning, God, Moshe told God, I think Rashi brings it, if not, I'll have to tell it to you by heart. No, Rashi doesn't bring it. Yes. Verse 17, Rashi says over there, Shalotishra, God said, I acquiesce to Moses. I don't think it's going to be, look at the article, you can see it in the article. 16, on the article, 505, the bottom corner, Viniflinu, and made distinct. This is a new request. Moses asked that the Jewish people be placed on a different level from all the other nations, that the divine presence in all its holiness, including the higher degree of prophecy, rest only upon Israel. In the following verse, God agreed to this request at all. Okay. Now, we got a problem here. Ladies and gentlemen, we have a problem here. When did Moses ask that the Jewish people be distinct from all the nations of the earth and that God only rest his divine presence upon the people? When did he ask for that?
After they sinned.
They sinned. Uh-huh. Okay, so that's a problem. I didn't understand. If you're going to ask that prayer, if Moses, this is a problem, why didn't Moses ask this before? Meaning, after you screw up, then you ask, you know, God, I need you to be fair. I want you to dwell here.
You don't have a very good bargaining.
So that's
Hashem was telling him, Moses, that the people were.
No, you're right. He already. Let's just get back to history. This is after. Be careful; it spills all over. This mind has a hole in the middle. So Moshe, what Moshe went up he got the first 10 commandments. Nothing to do. Rest only on the children of Israel. Nothing to do. He comes down and he prays and they shouldn't be destroyed for 40 days. I'm sorry, he goes back up, he prays again another 40 days, they shouldn't be destroyed. Fine, comes down, tells the people, okay, you're not going to be destroyed, but we don't have reconciliation yet. He goes back up the mountain and slowly over the 40 days he gains reconciliation to the point where God's willing to give them another set of 10 commandments. And Moses then throws down another few cards. One of those cards is, God, I want you exclusively in the full glory for the Jewish people.
But that was the understanding when they left Egypt.
Exactly.
So 1 minute, then I have another problem for you. If you're right, if that was the understanding when they left Egypt, I have another problem. What does the Medrash say? Medrash says that God went shopping prior to Sinai. He went around to the world,
yeah. And
he asked, you want to accept the Torah? No. What's written in it? Nah, not for us. You? Not for us. Not for us. Not for us. What does the Medrash mean? Let's say one of them would have said yes. Then what God was going to do? It's like a parent, you know. It's always dangerous when you ask your kids, "Do you want to go for pizza?" Right? And you really want to go for pizza today, or you don't want it, whatever it is. And one of them says yes or no. Oh, now you're up Schutz Creek, right? Now you're going, yeah, you know, you took a gamble. You got to be careful. So God was playing crap. He was playing poker. Now you could say because God knew all the cards everybody else was holding, so it wasn't a problem for God. But really, you're not allowed to do that. Is that God is not allowed to play poker, looking at other people's hands? And I'm sure there's got to be a movie where someone was playing God and playing poker. You know, really, how does he play poker? Because he knows everybody else's hands. You know, it's a problem. Okay. But how does, you know, how do you, right? So the answer is God had to be honest, right? If the Medrash is recording, God had to be honest. Meaning if one of them said yes, what would have happened? So the answer is like this, that what Moshe was, what happened here? There could have been more than one Jewish people. Right? We spoke about this a while back. What was the whole idea of the Jewish people? They were going a throwback to Adam. I mean, they were willing to dedicate themselves to live a spiritual, physical life. Right? Not a monotheistic moral life, but a spiritual life. So that became a Mamleches Kohanim V'Goy Kodesh, a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. So that could have been other people as well. Okay. What happened? With the sin of the golden calf, what Moshe realized is that the people are not all they are cut out to be. Right? Moshe recognized, right, unlike Solomon, Moshe realized he was a pragmatist. He recognized the people for all their foibles. Right? He was a true leader. And therefore he recognized that if they messed up once, like, they're going to mess up again. He understood. So therefore, Moshe prays to God that what he was afraid was that the people will mess up again, and then God is going to say, I'm fed up with this crap already. It's enough already. And trade him in. So therefore, Moshe was also afraid that there's not going to be a Moshe at that time. Right? What's he going to do? As long as Moses was around, he understood he could protect the Jewish people. But at some point, Moses knew he's going to die. So what's he going to do? So what he did is, he locked God into an exclusive contract. Right? He signed an exclusive contract with God. So, but 1 minute, then you have a problem. Because then you've locked everybody else out. So the answer is that no, because we have conversion. So he did not, at this point, he did not lock any individuals out. He simply said that everybody would have to travel through the Jewish people. Right? He would have to travel through the Jewish religion, or the Jewish people, I think. They would have to attach themselves to the Jewish people, and that's the point that changed at this point. Because otherwise Moshe was afraid that that they would not make it in the long haul. This is the reason, by the way, why the Jewish people have to suffer historically. Right? It sounds very sweet and nice to say, okay, we're in the locked-in contract with God, we have the exclusive rights of sole distributorship, right? But that's a very dangerous thing. Right. In fact, I was speaking with a number of people that have published books, just the Rabbi Wedekel we had speaking here, Doron Kornbluth. He had a book published. His first book published was published by an author, right? And you sell the rights, I guess, to the book to the publishing house. Mm-hmm. Right? That's how he signed the deal. I think most books are like that. Right? What ended up happening? The book company went bust, but they still owned the rights to the book. So he had to pay more money than they ever paid him
to get the rights.
To buy the rights book, the rights back. Right? Another speaker we had told me the same thing. He has the same problem. He comes once a year, I forgot. He had the same problem. His book was published. The company also went bust. And he says, even though they're bankrupt, they still own the rights to the book. Right? So therefore, he says, that's why a lot of people are not publishing. They're doing self-publishing and then selling distributor rights, but not the ownership rights of the book. Right? But 1 minute. So God has a problem. God signed an exclusive contract, so he's going to be up to Greek. Because let's say the Jewish people decide, it's not for us. But here, God is locked into the contract. That's why it has to be that there will always be people dedicated, and that's why you're going to see that God says he will shake up the people, mm-hmm. so that they will never have the ability on the long term and on the wholesale level to abandon the covenant with God. There will always be people that are dedicated to the covenant of God, and that will be an eternal. That's the eternal people. Mm-hmm. That's what it means. We're promised eternity. We're not promised eternity as individuals. There's no guarantee that any of us will forever remain in the good book. But as a nation, we will forever remain in the good book. Right? All of our efforts at drawing people closer to God and Judaism is only on individual levels, not on national levels. Meaning is whether Rabbi Weinberg had done the incredible work of Noach Weinberg of blessed memory, had done the incredible work of setting up Eshet Torah, with or without Rabbi Weinberg, the Judaism would have existed. What simply his contribution was that the masses of Jews connected to Judaism is his on his credit. Right? So you have individuals, each of us are writing our own story, right? We have miracles in our lives, but I'm saying each of us as individuals are writing our story, either attaching, as we said with the Rambam, either attach, keeping our leaf on the tree and holding fiercely to the great tree, or floating away from it. But it, as a nation, the nation Israel will always exist.
That word that is used for making a distinction is the word in modern Hebrew for discriminate. And to me, it's like we got put on notice. I had to live. If you live this way, everything's going to be okay. If you don't, then you're going to be discriminated against by everybody else in the world, and you're going to be
very good.
Punished.
That's what's his name? You know who says that?
That seems the Brisker Rav says it. There are many words you could have used to make for distinction. It's that word that also means when people are prejudiced against you.
The Brisker Rav says, he sums up yours in a pithy statement. He says, either a Jew makes kiddush, or the non-Jew makes Havdalah. Either a Jew sanctifies himself, or the non-Jewish world will make Havdalah, will separate you. And it's taken, yes. He took that from the Ger Rebbe, when the Reform movement in Germany published that a Jew can marry a German. So the Ger Rebbe, this was in 1880, he said there'll come a time when the Germans will say that a Jew can't marry a German. He wrote this in 1880. You could see it. It's quite a fascinating, scary, scary statement.
It's very scary because it does seem to work like that.
Yeah.
Right. And from one point of view. Yeah.
Right.
Do you remember George Burns?
Of course.
Did you ever see that movie?
Yeah.
Remember the great line when he was in court? They asked him to swear on the Bible, and he said, "I swear by Almighty Me." Wonderful.
Very good.
Wonderful line. Rabbi
Van, thank you
very much. Always an honor. Carson, we're going to sit together for a few minutes.
Yes.
Thank you for your answer to my question.
Rabbi, I think if you've got anything you want to talk about Wednesday.
Yeah, okay. One of us has to remember tomorrow to go through.
Yeah.
To go through the list.
I'll give you a call tomorrow.
I look forward.
Rabbi Ben, can you give this to your daughter? It was to help her for her...
This is for the charity?
Yes. And then I forgot my check. And now
this is for Adina?
Yeah.
Okay.
It still bothers me why Jacob didn't speak up for Dina.
Have a good one, Rabbi.
That's an excellent question. We'll have to wait for next year. Rebecca, is that a short answer? Because the truth Jacob was not saying that. I didn't want to get into the discussion.
Yes.
He was not saying that the boys were wrong. He never said that they were wrong. He said that they were not acting in a focused fashion. The truth is, if they were wrong, he would have said something else. If all of us, I think I said this even last year, I said that the truth is we all should take such strong stands, and we would not have the violation of women that we have today.
Uh-huh.
The problem is that we don't, and that's why we suffer. He was simply saying is that they did not focus, they didn't focus enough on the pragmatic issues, because what happened was that they put in danger everybody else. He said that you had no right to do. He said you should have taken her back, or we should have negotiated her return and not taken such a strong stand.
Yeah, but I wish he got upset. Jacob.
It says that he was upset. He said it took all of his energy not to respond strongly. But he had to be pragmatic how to get the daughter back safely.
Okay.
And if he would have shown immediately that he's very upset, so they could have easily just taken a stronger stand of saying, no, I'm not going to give back your daughter. I mean, they were trying...
Good morning,
Ruby. Hello, good morning. They were trying to win her release in a very practical... That's what it says, but they dealt with them in a very... tricky fashion.
Yeah.
You know, to try to catch him.
Thank you.
Okay, give me one second, Carson. Let me just kind of turn him around for a second.
Okay.
Shalom aleichem.
Shalom.
How are
you doing?
Fantastic. It's a witness.